Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Sorcerer and the Assassin by Stephen O'Shea. Narrated by Jake Ruddle. The Year 1242. Chapter 1. The insistent winter wind seemed to insinuate itself into every fold of cloak and tunic and reach right through to the bone. For the party of riders, the smiling south of the troubadours had given way to the brooding slope of the Black Mountain, to be descended gingerly. They picked their way down along a rocky track, their palfreys struggling to find purchase for their hooves along the fissures. Alongside the path, the harsh yellow of the broom shrubs shivered under a pale sun. There were a dozen of them, dressed in the red and gold livery of the Count of Toulouse. Save one, the youngest of the group, 15-year-old Fatima. She gripped her pony's mane and turned her unblemished face to scan the valley below, hoping for a sign of settlement, a village, perhaps even a town, that might function as respite from this windswept upland. Her master, Aymery of Montauban, steward of the Count of Toulouse, made a point of conducting an inspection of the Count's lands at all times of year, and Fatima was expected to accompany him, to cook and clean as she did when at home in the castle. Fatima disliked these forays into the country, even during the warmer months. The rustics stared at her, the youngest among them sometimes coming shyly forward to touch the dark skin of her hands. And though she had learned to smile and lightly brush them away, the attention made her feel like an outcast. Their fascination with her was so unlike the easy familiarity she enjoyed in the Count's castle. In Toulouse, daughters and sons of Al-Andalus had settled in the city as guarantors of peace, and others, like herself, had been stranded there after the death of parents on their way to the northern fairs to sell their wares of Cordovan leather and Toledan steel. Fatima had no memory of her mother and father, but she often wondered about them. Who were they? What were their dreams? What would they think of the child they had left behind? Perhaps they would have hoped for better than the life she led beneath the echoing vaults of the Count of Toulouse's kitchens. Fatima looked at her fingernails, crimson with pomegranate. Early mornings were spent scoring the red fruit, immersing it in water, then banging the husk to make the seeds fall into the mortar, there to be crushed by the pestle to render the pomegranate juice to flavour the meat and game. This red was far more palatable than the red of the blood month of November, when terrified sows and boars of the Count's estates were herded into pens set up in the courtyard to be stabbed and cut open. Squeals, moans, screams, a pitiful cacophony. The twitching carcasses would then be strung up by their hind trotters, the bristles of their hides scorched away by bunches of flaming straws, and, at last, butchered. Fatima crouched below the gibbet, wooden bucket in hand, catching the freely flowing blood and offal, which she then turned into the butifarra so prized by her masters. Yes, her parents would indeed be ashamed. Much as she questioned her lot as a servant, it was all that she had ever known. Compared to jolting down this rugged hillside today, her life of toil in the Count's castle seemed like a haven. There was always the easy banter with youngsters her own age, the flirting with the fresh boys behind the hayrick, the promise of a hot meal every evening. Fatima's pony slipped on the shale, interrupting her reverie. Just as well, for the leader of Steward Amory's armed sergeants had called for a halt. She strained to see the reason for the delay. Another group of horsemen was toiling its way up toward them, single file, heads bent into the wind. One of those heads was tonsured, the bald pate exposed to the elements. Its owner was perched unsteadily atop a mule, the hem of his long black habit grazing the rocks along the path. A Dominican friar. Fatima had seen these strange fellows in Toulouse. The presence of Dominicans usually spelled mischief, or worse, as they were known as capricious enforcers of God's will. Intrigued, the girl urged her pony forward to hear what it was the creature might desire.
"Oriol Cabard?"
Steward Amory was exclaiming, generations of aristocratic disdain for the clergy dripping from his voice.
"My dear brother Humbert, your god must have led you astray. The village of Oriol lies over there, to the west, not a league away." Amory gestured grandly with a gloved hand in that direction. But climb no further. You have reached the height of the village. You will know you are near it when the land becomes a plateau. No need for divine guidance. Brother Humbert of Chartres held the steward in a level gaze. The fierceness of his faith glowed from his dark eyes, his gaunt features betraying a piety tinged with mortification. Humbert would not humour this man of the south with a reply. He had grown accustomed to the insolence and godlessness of these accursed southern noblemen, still smarting from the sound beating they had suffered at the hands of the French northerners over the past 20 years. Steward Amory spurred his steed to one side of the track, making way for the Dominican friar and his party to proceed. But the steward's movements revealed the rest of his retinue, including Fatima. Humbert sat back on his mule as if struck. He would never have expected one such as she to find employ in the service of Toulouse. "What strange company you keep, Steward Amory," Humbert finally said, in a voice redolent of the mellifluous tones of the rainy north. "Am I mistaken, or is that not a daughter of Balthazar, one of the three magi, the only one to be as black as sin?" All eyes swiveled in her direction. Fatima stared at some dry twigs of thyme on the ground, silently cursing the curiosity that had impelled her to spur her pony forward. Curiosity had landed her in trouble before, peering around a corner to see what she shouldn't, straining to hear a whispered exchange, and once, in her master's armory, even hefting a sword she had no business touching, an infraction that had cost her a dozen lashes of the Count's cravache. To worsen matters, a freshening breeze seemed to toy with her modest cloak, so as to leave her open to Brother Humbert's unwelcome gaze. A stronger gust blew back her hood, revealing her tight, dark curls, so dissimilar to the compliant plaits of her white sisters. "Friar Humbert," the steward responded with some impatience, "this loyal servant has been a member of Count Raymond's household since childhood, and is now grown into a capable and commendable wench to whom I entrust the feeding and care of my party, whenever we must needs travel to serve our lord." He might have added that this girl, this Fatima, betrayed a nobility of movement and demeanour unusual for one in such a lowly station in life. But Steward Amory held his tongue. Humbert looked unconvinced. "Our provincial will be notified," he said in a low voice. "We take a dim view of such impieties. Need I remind you, sir, that above all else, we are servants of Christ?" "And a good day to you too, brother." The contempt in the steward's voice was no longer accompanied by even the ghost of a smile. He eased his heels into the flanks of his chestnut palfrey and signalled his escort to resume their descent. The interview was over. As Fatima came closer to the Dominican, she resolved not to look away. Instead, she passed brazenly before the glowering friar, her eyes staring insolently into his. She noted the typical clerical mix of hatred and hunger dwelling there, and narrowed her gaze, willed herself not to blink. Only after passing him did she realize she'd been holding her breath. As the friar urged his mount towards the village of Oriol, Fatima glanced over her shoulder to look at the receding figure. The world, she thought, had no need of men such as him, and if ever she had the power to turn her beliefs into action, she would do what she could to cleanse his like from the earth. Chapter 2. Brother Humbert could nearly smell the malodorous attar of her wantonness as she rode by, daring to lock glances with him, a man of God. He drew himself up in his ostentatiously humble saddle, hoping to regain the authority he had felt slipping away ever since glimpsing this Moorish daughter of Al-Andalus. "Gaitan," the friar said, addressing the strapping leader of his armed escort, "the day grows late. You are to take 3 men and ride ahead to Oriol. Round up all the villagers, tell them the word of Christ will soon be among them. If any of them dare to disobey the summons, they risk their eternal soul." Gaitan and his men galloped through the Garrigue until they were out of sight, disappearing behind a knoll. Humbert reflected on what lay ahead. A village of the foul-smelling and the filthy, totally unaware of how they were nesting in a bed of heretical pestilence. 3 decades had been spent trying to eradicate the evil creed of the Cathars from the lands of the Long Dark, thanks to the Holy Knights of the North and the sermons of the sainted Dominic. But no matter how many of the southern vermin were killed by the flash of the sword and the flame of the fire, there always remained some who clung to the noxious faith of their fathers. Ignorant, stubborn, diabolical, more likely. Humbert spurred his mule to a trot, eager to root out these foxes in the vineyards of the Lord. A week previously, his spies had come to him in Carcassonne and told him that Auriol Cabardès was a hotbed of the heterodox, isolated from the influence of the church in the more hospitable reaches of the valleys far below the Black Mountain. Humbert looked murderously at the tendrils of grey smoke now visible in the middle distance, the cooking fires of these wretches. He had sacrificed his studies in Chartres to join the Order of Dominic, to effect change in the world, to rescue the laity from its embrace of the flesh. And when, shortly after Dominic had died, his Dominican friars were appointed by the Holy Father to form something new, an Inquisition, to track down and exterminate heretics, Humbert knew he had found his true calling. He spent 4 years of study in the newly founded Dominican University at Toulouse, learning of the unspeakable beliefs and practices of these devils, and the methods of correcting them through Inquisition and torture. The villagers of Auriol would learn that he, the Inquisitor of Carcassonne, was not to be defied. Humbert smiled grimly as his mount waded into a throng of villagers in a paddock, their dirty faces upturned in anticipation. He would give them something to remember. He dismounted and climbed up on a trestle table that Gaetan had set up as an improvised dais. "My children, my children," Humbert began sweetly, the French inflection of his Occitan almost seductive. "I have journeyed here all the way from Carcassonne to save you. For so great is the love of the church for all of you that even the most illustrious of its members," he inclined his head in false modesty, "will make his way through the briars and the nettles to speak to you as a pastor." The crowd before Humbert remained impassive. A moment of silence passed. The friar scanned the gallery of faces as if trying to divine where the heresy lurked. Humbert thought these peasants to be contemptible bumpkins. It was a wonder that he bestirred himself in the service of saving their befouled souls. If anything, he thought, they should be crowding around the trestle table for the opportunity of kissing his sandals or the hem of his black robe. He recognized that he would have to speak in a way their limited reasoning could grasp, a preaching precept drilled into him during his time in Toulouse. He knew that many of the Black Mountain were shepherds. "Heretics are wolves in sheep's clothing," Humbert said loudly. "They endanger the entire flock." He raised a great staff and waved it slowly back and forth over the heads of the crowd. Then he froze it over one man, who shrank back reflexively. This was precisely the reaction Humbert was hoping for, a spasm of fear. But the fellow was an exception. The rest of the villagers remained unmoved, their tired eyes trained on Humbert as if inspecting a prize rooster for purchase. The friar could see that their dislike for him as a busybody equaled his dislike for them as apostates. Humbert and his listeners shared a moment of uncomfortable silence. The Dominican took a deep breath. This was no time to deploy the fancy Parisian rhetoric, not when faced with these oafs. "You have returned to the noxious embrace of heresy," he roared. "Your souls will roast in hell for eternity." Silence again. Somewhere nearby, a horse whinnied. Humbert looked down for a moment. he had to make these villagers understand that he and his brethren in the Holy Office of the Inquisition knew all about their disgusting heretical practices. He had studied them, his stomach churning, in his years of schooling in Toulouse.
"You must repent! You are an abomination!" Humbert shouted. "Your errors are too vile. You are sullied. Evil has taken root within you. You must reject the lascivious practices of the devils among you. Incestuous copulation. You lie with your brothers, your sisters, your mother, your father. Demonic debauchery of the flesh. Then you roast and devour the misshapen infants spewed out by such sinful congress."
He caught his breath and looked out over a sea of skepticism. A few heads turned to one another, smiles growing on their faces. Humbert grunted like a gored bull. He would have to inform them that he knew of the most despicable of their practices.
"You fornicate with cats! With cats! Have you no shame?"
"Caw! Caw!"
It was a young woman's voice, taunting.
"Dominican crow! Caw! Caw!"
His black habit had not gone unnoticed. A wave of laughter rippled through the crowd. Everyone loved Kara. She was a spirited slip of a girl, a young beauty as yet untamed, and not one to be intimidated by a black-robed friar, no matter how important he claimed to be.
"Caw! Caw!"
Kara smiled at her neighbours, her friends, her kinsmen. "We are simple people," she thought, "minding our flocks, tending our vines, with an understanding of the good that this silly Frenchman knows nothing about. We fornicate with cats. The crow is a madman. How can he believe such nonsense? We had heard tell these Dominican crows were afraid to touch a woman, so they spent their time playing with one another. Well, more power to them. When her time came, she would choose a man worthy of her appetites, aching to be with her, a stallion to her mare." She felt the eyes upon her as she adjusted her simple tunic. Her golden hair shifted languidly in the wind. It was good to be alive and held safe in the hundredfold thoughts of the village. Humbert's face betrayed no emotion at the cries of the heckler. He thought silently on what lay ahead. He knew these creatures to be a pestiferous boil on the mystical body of Christ. Either they would recant their error, or he would burn them alive.
"My children," he said, changing tack, a counterfeit sweetness in his voice. "You have 2 days to think over whether you will come to me of your own accord and beg absolution. If you do, I shall be merciful. You can come to me at any time, day or night, to make your confessions and request forgiveness. If you are a good and true Christian, you have nothing to fear. But you must also tell me who else among you is afflicted with the illness of heresy. I want names. Do not withhold any names because they are your friends or your kin. It is your duty to tell all. If you are found to have held back names, then you too will be punished." After a long pause, he raised his right hand and performed a blessing. Sourly, he noted that some in the crowd did not cross themselves in response. During his training as Inquisitor, he had been taught that these heretics reviled the symbolism of the cross. More than a few of the villagers kept their hands at their sides.
2 days, my children. You have 2 days, Humbert said softly. Do not return to heresy, like a dog returning to its vomit.
Gaetan helped Humbert down from his perch. Although he was still young, long seasons of study and prayer and fasting had turned this warrior for Christ into a frail man. But what he lacked in strength, he made up for in conviction. These insects would be squashed. The crowd parted to make way for Gaetan and the friar.
In the heavy stillness, a persistent breeze could be heard rustling through a spinney of poplars. A shrike gave out a shrill cry in the dying sunlight as it impaled an insect on a thorn. When the outsiders had finally passed into the village chapel, the people of Oriol dispersed. There was much to think about. Instinctively, wives sought out their husbands, their children, their mothers. Hands closed over hands as families made their way back home in silence. Once indoors, the frantic, fearful discussions would begin, lasting long into the night. 4 hours later, the blackness was absolute, the stars brilliant, the night locked in the grip of midwinter. The village was quiet, save for the occasional yelp of a dog, and all had entered their first sleep of the evening. They would wake, naturally, at around midnight, perform some chores, or perhaps make love, then go back to their second sleep, awakening only when the world of light was once more. In the dimness of the chapel, a straw bed had been laid out in the front of the nave for Brother Humbert. Gaetan stood guard outside the door, and the scribes and notaries had been given places in a nearby manger. The visitors had also entered their first sleep, and now slumbered profoundly, wearied by the arduous uphill journey they had undertaken earlier in the day from Carcassonne. The men accompanying the friar were from the gentle Aude Valley, unaccustomed to scaling the slope of the Black Mountain. Oriol Cabardès had the distinct disadvantage of being nestled close to the summit of the escarpment. Humbert of Chartres, who had been raised in the placid plains and meadows of the Beauce, was even less accustomed to such rugged uplands. An odd, muffled sound came from outside the door. Humbert opened his eyes on his pallet. True, in his sermon he had said they could come at any time, day or night, but these heretics were such a damnable nuisance sometimes. With more resignation than anticipation, he got to his feet, brushing away stray strands of straw from his cassock. It was true that people generally preferred betraying their neighbours under cover of night. Human nature must be manured with fear to yield a crop for the torturer. He moved toward the door. It opened. Humbert squinted. Instead of Gaetan's being there, the silhouette of a large, robed man filled the doorframe. Definitely not one of the scrawny villagers. Behind the figure, on the flagstones, lay a shapeless lump of a thing in a spreading pool of darkness. Gaetan. In the starlight, Friar Humbert of Chartres had time only to see the faint flash of the blade before it was driven deep into the bridge of his nose. Chapter 3. It was a chill afternoon in the goodly Christian city of Toulouse, and Brother Pons of Bram, a burly Dominican friar, ran up the muddy street towards the Sailhan house, home to the Inquisition. Pond's haste commanded respect, and passers-by parted to allow the big young man to continue on his way. In response to his pounding on the door, a bolt slid, and the Dominican on guard in the threshold let him pass, reassured by his black and white habit. Pond's took the stairs two at a time. On reaching the upper floor, he burst into the first room on the left.
"Terrible tidings," Pond's said breathlessly. "Brother Humbert is dead, murdered."
"Good Lord, when?"
responded his superior, Brother Pierre of Tours.
"Yesterday. We've only just got word."
Brother Pierre gripped the arms of his chair.
"These people are plague-sore carbuncles."
A thin man, with the pursed lips of the ascetic, Pierre of Tours did not like surprises. For a man of faith, change was an enemy, resistance an insult. Pierre had almost rejected his elevation to the rank of Grand Inquisitor of Toulouse, an unheard-of act of defiance in the Dominican order, on the grounds that the people of the Languedoc were an impossible, immoral lot, practitioners of obscene rituals at every new moon, justifying their unnatural lusts with a perverted creed that seemed to well up out of the accursed soil and infect every generation. The sainted Dominic himself had debated these Cathar heretics for years, tried to pull them out of their filth, all to no avail. It was only after much prayer that Pierre had been told by God to shoulder his cross and move to this land of infamy. So, he had a dead inquisitor to deal with, struck down by the very heretics he was charged to hunt. The wretches had never gone this far before. In the early days of the Holy Office, some 10 years previously, several inquisitors had been given a rough reception in the towns and cities they visited, but no blood was shed.
Where?
Oriol Cabardes, on the Black Mountain.
Never heard of it.
It is a small village, remote.
Pierre of Tours got to his feet and smoothed the folds of his robe. Clearly, he was to have no tranquillity for many a day. He looked searchingly at his young aide.
You were from the Long Dock, Brother Pons. The town of Bram, if memory serves. What's the reputation of this Oriol?
A thoughtful expression crossed Pons' fleshy features.
The people of the Black Mountain are said to be superstitious, believers in black magic, and they keep to themselves.
Are they thought to be dangerous?
No more than anybody else up there. Every now and then there's a brawl over a stolen sheep or some other matter. And on the Feast of St. Vincent, when the wine is passed around in his honour, the odd fistfight isn't that rare.
But they're not a murderous lot.
Pons shook his head.
I want them all rounded up.
The whole village? But, Brother Pierre, begging your indulgence, the whole village did not commit the crime.
Pierre's face clouded. Even his most trusted confederates would allow him no serenity.
They are all complicit, he said fiercely. All of them. Every man, woman, and child.
They had all conspired to disturb his peace and quiet. Pons' eyes widened as the Grand Inquisitor continued in a steady voice.
Tell the civil authorities that on pain of excommunication, they are to dispatch a squad of armed men to arrest all the villagers. Then they will be brought in chains here to our prison.
Pierre noticed the dubious look on Pons' face.
What is it?
Oriol is far from Toulouse. Carcassonne is much closer.
Pierre waved his hand as if batting away a fly.
Very well, then. We will travel to Carcassonne to question them ourselves. Lock them up in the wall.
Chapter 4. The Wall of Carcassonne, the name given to the Inquisition's prison, lowered over the right bank of the River Aude, its mute stone facade a reminder of the dread power of church and crown. Facing it, across the river, rose the lower town, the dwelling place of the prosperous burghers of Carcassonne. Half-timbered houses, warehouses, shop trestles, all teemed with the commotion of commerce. Behind the wall, on a commanding height, stood the battlements of the upper town, its many turrets and towers brooking no challenge to authority. Unlike the county of Toulouse, Carcassonne and its surroundings belonged to the Kingdom of France. The royal seneschal resided in the upper town, as did his men-at-arms. In an act of munificence, the seneschal had granted the Dominicans their own tall tower in the line of massive stone fortifications. Whenever inmates of the wall had to be interrogated by the friars, they would be led in shackles up the steep hill that separated the prison from the Inquisition Tower. Master Vidal, a local man with a gift for inflicting pain, performed his trade with little ceremony. Stocky, bearded, in midlife, with a shock of bushy eyebrows that gave him a look of perpetual surprise, Vidal nodded as Pierre of Tours issued his instructions. The suspect today was a young woman of Oriol, who had been taken captive 3 days previously with all her fellow villagers and imprisoned in the wall. She was a willowy, fetching creature, Brother Pierre thought, so unlike the homely womanhood of the countryside. He had learned that the girl was a troublemaker.
Now, Cara, my child, Pierre said, are you going to tell me who murdered holy Brother Humbert?
The interpreter beside him asked the question in Occitan.
I know not, Cara replied, her eyes darting around the gloom in search of something
anything that was familiar. What is this place? Who is this crow?
Sample complete. Ready to continue?